was that I had to come up with a positive meaning in life that could withstand any argument that any person could use or could come up with. And because I actually felt that way, it was simply a question of finding the words. I truly felt that way. The feeling of that was much deeper, and Bob put the stamp on that much, much later when he said certain things to me about what my connection with him was. But at that time, I was in a wilderness in terms of not finding any identifiable sources that I could relate to and said, well, that person or this thought has been held before. Pretty much I was alone because I didn't do much reading outside of my school. So when I finally, the final result of that one class was, there was almost like a great weight lifted off of everybody. There was a depression in the class because of what this other person said. So my point of view did prevail. And I felt the lifting of the weight off of me. I had the great need. They had a need too, but I had a greater need. Because that was an ongoing thing that I had experienced all the time in my life. So I did prevail. And basically what it amounted to was I said those things which established to the relief and satisfaction of everyone else that there was great meaning in life. And that great meaning was intimately connected with all of us. And it would result in a person having a basically optimistic point of view, a positive point of view. My own personal way of looking at how I looked at life was, if there was pain in what I saw, there was something wrong. There was something wrong in the way I looked at it. I couldn't for the life of me figure out how to look at it in a different way so that there wouldn't be pain, but I just knew there had to be a different way. So you see, this is the kind of thing that led up ultimately to Baba. And then I'd heard about, from a cousin that I was very close to and whose opinion I highly regarded. She was a person not easily influenced. She was a very beautiful young woman, very beautiful. And notwithstanding that, she was a very fair-minded person, the kind of person that you could like. She didn't take advantage of those advantages you already had. She was a very fair-minded person. Well, the fact that she had heard something about lectures that this girl, who was the sister of someone I'd gone to law school with, had attended, and that she was so impressed with those lectures, in spite of the fact that she could not tell me one single thing about those lectures, the fact that she was impressed was something that was absolutely important to me, because I knew how little really impressed her. She was wonderful to everybody, but she was never impressed that much. And here she was telling about some philosophy that she had heard from this girl at a cocktail party, and she was so impressed. Well, that went on for a year. I knew the person, the brother, but I didn't know the girl. So I finally, in a rather unusual, what would be lightly termed coincidental way, but it wasn't really a coincidence, I was walking down the street in downtown Richmond, Virginia, when the streets were filled with people shopping. And I see this person that I'd gone to law school with, and he's with another man and a woman. The woman was his sister. The woman was the one my cousin had referred to. So I said, oh, I know she's here now. I was introduced, you know. I didn't want to bring up, even if I knew how to bring it up, but I didn't. I didn't want to bring it up now, just talking socially. So I said, I know she's here now, and I'll get in touch with her, because it was very much on my mind. So later on, the very same afternoon, after we'd had coffee, we parted. That same afternoon, I bumped into her again. This time she was alone on the downtown streets of crowded Richmond. So then, since she was alone, I went up to her and I said, you know, my cousin said she was at a cocktail party and that you had, about a year ago, and you had said something about some lectures you'd taken. And I said, really, I was so interested in that. And can you tell me something about it? And I really didn't know anything unusual in those days. I suppose the most unusual thing that I would know about in terms of spiritual beliefs would be Christian Science. As I said, I haven't read anything. Or I hadn't at that time. I may have read Gurdjieff. I don't know, one book, In Search of the Miraculous. I may have read that one book. But I'm not quite sure that I read it then. Could have been afterwards. But she then told me about some lectures she had taken from a Dr. Walter Russell, who lived in this marble mansion that was built by a very wealthy man who had made his millions in tobacco. And this place was in Waynesboro, Virginia, the western part of my state, on Afton Mountain. That's where this mansion was. The man's name was Dr. Walter Russell. The place that he established there for these insights that he revealed was called Swannanoa. And it sounded rather far-fetched. It didn't sound far-fetched at the time she was telling me. Later, when I thought about going there, I thought it was rather far-fetched. So at the time, she said she will see if she had any literature at home left. And that's when I found out that she was leaving for Paris the next morning. I would not have seen her, nor did I see her for years afterwards. She was taking some advanced courses in architecture in Paris. And so she called me that night, and she said she'd given everything away. But I did get the name and address, and I wrote. And I got some of the things that some of the books he had written. And as my interest began to weaken to some extent, it was rekindled by the fact that there were two doctors having dinner with my sister one evening. They were taking specialist courses at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond. They were both from Lebanon. We got into a discussion, a philosophical discussion, a spiritual discussion after dinner. I suppose I must have gone into some of the conclusions that I had come to based upon my own insights, based upon my own needs. And they were very well versed in philosophy, all the philosophers. And as they were driving me home that evening from my sister's house, one of them said, or perhaps both of them, one of them said and the other sort of agreed, they said, "Henry, we don't really go in for religion at all. But if we ever could, it would be along the lines that you were talking about this evening." Well, that gave me some confidence that here are people that whose opinion I felt was based upon a good mind and a genuineness. So that made me feel a little bit more encouraged, because about that time I was thinking, I'm starting to practice, going on the top of a mountain somewhere, you know, prophet. And also my wife was the one that really pushed me, because anything like that, my wife would push me. So I ended going up to Swannanoa in Waynesboro, Virginia, and took this two-week course there. I met Dr. Walter Russell, who was in his 80s at that time. Walter Russell had not ever gone to school, according to him. He said he didn't need any teacher because God was his teacher. And yet he was a recognized person in so many different fields. He designed and built some millions of dollars worth of buildings in New York City in the 20s. He became president of the Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he pointed out where the Mendeleev atomic chart was wrong, and that all elements are in the process of becoming totally stable in the form of pure carbon, which would be diamond. And so consequently, in the progression of these elements towards this total stable state, there were these isotopes and there were these in-between relatively unstable states. And this apparently had to do with identifying those fissionable elements. So all of this was copyrighted back in, he was doing this work at Columbia back in 26, I think. And then he wrote, he said he had been out of his, he had a spiritual experience that gave him a perspective of knowing so much that he would not know ordinarily. He called it being out of his body for a long period of time, like 30 some days or 30 days. I wasn't so much interested in the physical way that the creation was constructed. I was more interested in values. Values. Something that an individual could find to be so real and so meaningful that they could become the means by which he would develop a definite reality for himself that would withstand everything in life. That's what I was more interested in. I wasn't, although he had people, heads of science departments from various universities coming up there, they were fascinated with him. But I wasn't so interested in the science aspect of it, you see. But of course, I tried to understand the various things that he pointed to. He became a great portrait painter. His painting of the Might of Ages. He never took any lessons of any kind. King of Belgium at that time, he said, I never sought any honor, but this, the award for his, this award that he won as a result of his painting of the Might of Ages. The King of Belgium came to his studio to present the award. The important thing being that he never really went after any material thing in life. When he was president of the Academy of Arts and Sciences, they were going to honor Edison. Well, they wanted to commission this very outstanding sculptor to do a bust of Edison. Well, he was unavailable to get it done in time for honoring Edison. So he decided that he would do it himself. He had never sculpted before. So he went through this process that would surface the necessary knowledge. He called it decentration. But whatever it was, and whatever it involved, he went through that, and he was able to understand and know the essential elements involved in sculpture. And so he did this. He did the bust of Edison. And he became quite outstanding as a sculptor. He did the Four Freedoms at the United Nations, and he became the personal sculptor to the Roosevelt family. His bust of Roosevelt's at Churchill's home. And he would tell us how to... His hand would shake, but when he started to paint, it became absolutely still. His pulse was kept way low. I don't know, very low. And he seemed to have that kind of control. I think his first wife tried to have him committed when he was having this experience. And the doctor, who's a psychiatrist, in seeing him, said, I don't know what this man is going through, but he is certainly not deranged. It is something very meaningful here, although I don't understand it. Anyway, so I met Walter Russell, and at that time he was telling us about meditating. A group of us were discussing meditation one time. And when I would meditate along the line, he said, I was aware of light somewhere in this area of my forehead getting bigger and bigger and bigger, which meant that my consciousness was being withdrawn from consciousness of everything else. And I had never had any experience of this nature before, nor did I know anything about any of these things these people were talking about. I had no knowledge of this. And he heard me talking about, we were all telling how we experienced what we were, the kind of meditation we were going through. So he invited me to lunch and we talked about these things. Anyhow, the main thing was that he had only recommended two books for us to read. One was Cosmic Consciousness, which was a collection of the experiences of people throughout history, including Walt Whitman, even Jesus, and others, you know. Sir Oliver Lodge, I believe, Edward Carpenter, people who had had experiences of a very profound nature, spiritual experiences, experiences of reality, however you want to call them. And Dr. Richard Maurice Buck had lived a very vigorous life fighting the Indians, doing all sorts of things before he settled down and became a doctor and then a psychiatrist. He was Canadian. He himself had been in London. He was returning from an apartment where they were reading Byron poetry. And all of a sudden he was aware of certain things. He thought what he referred to as a storm beginning to happen. And then he realized the experience was within himself. And then he had this experience. The effect of it was he laughed at things like death, things that everyone is afraid of. From that experience, he was aware that death was absolutely nothing to be afraid of. I don't remember the details of it. I would say generally that from it he gained a great realization that there was incredible meaning in life and that our ignorance was what kept us from realizing our intimate connection with this great, great meaning that would make us feel very good. Okay, well, as a result of that, he wanted to find out who else had that experience. And that resulted in this book. The other book he recommended was the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita had great meaning for me. The little paperback edition that I picked up had an introduction by Aldous Huxley. I found that Aldous Huxley was a member of the editorial board of the Vedanta Society of Southern California. And it seems to me somehow or other I got to write to the center, the Ramakrishna Center in New York City. The head of that was Swami Nikalananda, who was a great scholar recognized by the universities up there, Columbia, I don't know what else. But I do remember a whole page in the New York Times about him one time. Well, he translated so many of these works from the Sanskrit. His volume, the complete gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, the complete works of Vivekananda, the Upanishads, his translation of the Bhagavad Gita with his commentary and all that. Well, we're getting close to Baba finally. I wrote to him and I said, I am tired of reading about the reality that I am now convinced exists. I must meet someone who experiences that reality. He wrote me back. He was just leaving for Europe. He said, you must come to see me in New York when I return. It would be a great rare occurrence for you to be able to meet one such as Ramakrishna. But a being of his spiritual stature comes along perhaps once in 500 years. And in spite of the fact that would be the rarest stroke of good fortune, it's not necessary for your spiritual growth. And he said, you must come to see me. So I had that in the back of my mind. Well, this friend of my wife's came down from New York, Liz Sicalis. And Liz was a very real person. Liz could take a car apart and put it back together. Liz was athletic. And she and my wife are very close friends. They grew up together in Williamsburg. So I told her about everything I had found out in this very short space of time. I read all the Upanishads. I read the Gospel of Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, self-knowledge. I read everything I could get my hands on. And all of these things had great familiarity to me, great meaning for me. So when I told her that, she said she went back to New York and she was walking on clouds for 3 weeks, which didn't surprise me because it impressed me enormously. And I always felt that she would be similarly inclined when real meaning came along. Well, in appreciation, in 1955, she sent as a Christmas present to me and my wife a book. The title of the book was God Speaks. I believe that was only in one place. That was for sale in one place in New York at that time. Anyway, the remarkable thing was, it was certainly not a coincidence. I received the book, opened it in my office, looked at Baba's picture. I may have read the inside of the cover and its continuation on the back part of the cover. I immediately picked up the telephone, called New York, and Liz Sicalis was a very responsible person. I think she worked for a time in a woman's prison. She didn't need to work. Her father had provided her with an income from real estate in her name or something like that. But that's not her nature. Her nature is a very responsible, thrifty person. She was at home. This was about 11:30. I said, Liz, I have your book about Mahir Baba. Yes. Okay. So I told her I had the book God Speaks. I said, Liz, Mahir Baba is the one. Find out how we can meet him. By one, I suppose what I really meant was, because I hadn't read the book, nor did I know the mechanics of spiritual hierarchy or anything of that nature that Baba I learned subsequently from Baba. What it meant was that this man knew everything there was to know. This man was the authority. That's how I would view. I had no question whatsoever. My conviction was 100%. That's right. So we waited very on pins and needles. I was a very practical person. But there wasn't any question about the way I felt about this. So consequently, it was inevitable that I would feel this way. Well, finally she called. She said she'd gone to the publishers, Dodd Mead in New York. They said he had been in the United States in 1952, but they did not expect him back. So then I wrote a letter, special delivery air mail directly to Mayor Baba. There was the King's Road Ahmednagar address. I used that. And my letter was typewritten from my office. I said, Dear Mahir Baba, I have your book, God Speaks. It has great meaning for me. I want to meet you, and I don't think that's impossible. And I received an email reply that he would be in New York. Baba had dictated a portion of that reply. The following, I believe it was May, and what I should do, this, then, the other thing. The second letter, he said, your connection with me is of long duration. You're one of the fortunate ones, and some other things like that. And so I met him for the first time, and then I began to write to him. And by that time, I totally believed that I was writing to God. I had no question in my mind about that. And the biggest difficulty involved in that is that now God had become identifiable and approachable, and I could directly say things to him and get a response. So my great difficulty was, what do you say to God? You see? So in order to deal with that enormous difficulty, it was very necessary for me to become very genuine and very real. And ultimately what it really meant to me, I had to become a poet. Because ultimately what it meant, I didn't need to ask him anything. I need to find a way to praise him. So my efforts were very clumsy efforts at praising him. I needed to become a poet, but you can't wait for your need to be fulfilled. You had to do. So I wrote to him that way. I would write on legal pads, trying to praise him the best way I was able to. And Baba did respond to that. He sent me letters telling me things, and my love touched him very deeply. And I would get a cable every now and then, your love makes me very happy. In 1958, he did say, in reference to those letters, such love letters from a lawyer. All right. So I met him in 1956 for the first time at the Hotel Delmonico. We drove up, my wife and I, and Liz Sicalis and her sister were also going to meet him there. We drove all the way to New York. My wife was instructed by her mother to go shopping and buy a dress for the engagement party for her brother. So I was let out at the Hotel Delmonico while she was going to go to these stores to get her dress. I was going to meet God while she... In a way, it's that. My wife is a marvelous woman. Marvelous. And Baba said some beautiful things about her. Keecha is tinsel to my light. Tinsel to my light. You try to make others happy. Let me make you happy. Your mother and father love me very much. Things of this nature. There wasn't any question about the fact. But her way of approaching Baba was in a different way than mine. We sort of balanced each other. And again, I said, Baba had said, I gave you a very beautiful family, Henry. Be sure you take care of them and all that. You're both under my divine thumb in 58. Well, in 56, so I'm going up there. Again, there are people, all sorts of people there, milling about at the Hotel Delmonico in the corridor, talking this, talking that. Now, the specific date, no, I believe it was in May, but the date that he was actually at the Hotel Delmonico is very clear. I mean, that's as to whether it was the day he arrived, the day after he arrived, I don't know. But I do believe it was in May. And when I got there, when I got up to that floor, all this activity was going on. Everybody's name was taken. John Bass wanted to make sure. I believe the Winnefelds were there. But their primary purpose was to make sure everyone had an audience with Baba. And so when I finally had my opportunity to go into the room where Baba was, when I looked at him, my reaction and my feeling was one of total knowing of this person. Total knowing of this person. And in trying to make clear what that means, there was no barrier of any kind. There's always a barrier between one person and another person. There's always a barrier between a person and someone who is very close as a friend to that person, or a relative, or a mother, or a father. There's always a barrier. Things you would not say, whatever. There was absolutely no barrier between me and that person, which meant that those things that I wouldn't tell a soul, I wouldn't have hesitated to say to him. That's what I mean when I say this man, I had always known him. That kind of closeness, such an intimate closeness. Someone asked me the other day if I remembered what color jacket. I said, no, I just looked at his face. So I went up to him and I embraced him. and whispered into his ear, "I adore you." That's all. And Bob was smiling. I don't even remember anything he said to me. All I was doing was looking. I don't remember a thing that was transpired. All I do remember is that when finally I was let out into the corridor where everyone went after they finished having their interview with Baba, I was totally 100% dissatisfied. I didn't feel that I said what I needed to say to him, didn't know what to say to him, and he was God, and I wanted to look at God in human form, how he blinks, how he turns his head, everything. That if I could not see the Godness there, my blindness, if it looked enough, would see. I said there wasn't any question in my mind that his reality would touch the deepest aspect in me if I looked long enough. And in the interim, it was the most fascinating of all thoughts to know that I was looking at someone who was God, that I was convinced was God. So every time that door opened, Erich let somebody out, I kept trying to look in there. Everybody else was having their conversations in groups in the corridor. And this went on for a number of times, and finally the door opened and Erich came over to me and said, "Baba says, what do you want?" And I said, "I must see him again." So I was allowed to go back in. And I stayed there. I don't know how long I stayed there. And I still could not come up with what I felt was the right thing. I could not strip away everything false about myself. I could not find my own reality enough to address this great reality. And that was very troubling to me. So the best I could do was to say, "I must experience the truth, Baba." And he smiled like I had said something great. It was totally inadequate as far as I was concerned because I was not feeling real, you see. But I had said the best that I could come up with this time span, within the constraints of time. And he said, he smiled, his response was so much more than in my judgment this very small statement would justify. And he went like that. He said, "You will experience the truth." And he said, "I am helping you. I will help you." Well, again, I don't remember anything that took place between us then, except that I did get an opportunity to look at him, to see how he talked, how he, you know, gestured and moved around. And then again, when I was let out, I was there for a longer time now. And then finally, I was let out into the car, and finally my wife arrives. And when my wife arrived, she's a very formidable woman, very formidable woman. And when she found out that I had gone in to see Baba before she got back, she was very, very irritated without saying it. But you could feel it. You could feel it emanating from her every pore. And the fact that she could not understand why I would not wait was the most infuriating thought in my, that gave me a feeling of furiousness in myself. I was furious. The person couldn't understand how I would wait to see this being who was God on earth. So this is the total kind of thing that was going on between us without any word being spoken. And at that time, Baba sent for us. And we went in together. And when Baba saw us, he put his hands on both sides of his head. And he shook his head like this and said, "My God." He could feel what was coming out of us. So she went down and sat in front of him. And Baba reached up and pulled her earring off and rolled it up in her hand and was smiling at her. And then he began to feed her grapes. And this was, again, I don't remember what went on between them. I was sort of out of it in terms of the details. I was so fascinated with him. Well, the second time we saw him was in 1958, and my wife tells me that...
That was only that one day.
Yes, yes.
Then he drove back down.
Yes. Then, I don't know how long we stayed up there, but anyway, after his visit here in 1956, I began writing to him again. And so at some point my wife tells me I must have found something somewhere in his discourses where he said those who want special instructions because of their circumstances should communicate with me. And it was for that reason that I wrote to him. He said, "You must come to India." Baba said, "You must come to India." And I was planning on going to India. Well, then Baba changed it, you know.
To go and live in India.
Well, I didn't know. It was open. I mean, this man was the totality of everything that had meaning. So I was planning to go to India. It was open-ended as to what I would do. And then, of course, it changed. Baba came to the United States in 58. So that when we went down to see him at Myrtle Beach in 58 and spend the 2 weeks down there, I had this familiarity with Baba. I had this correspondence from Baba, cables from Baba. So when I got down there, and the people that were there, really, Baba didn't pay much attention to me. And that was the greatest shock to me, because he meant everything to me. And it was as though I didn't exist in a way, my way of looking at it. And so this was a tremendously severe conflict. The one that meant everything didn't even look my way. He sent for this one and that one. Everybody was more important than me. Everyone there was more important. So I had to deal with that conflict. I had to resolve it. I had to resolve it honestly. I could never resolve it in any other way. The way I resolved it, after going through an agony, was to, the great, great need was to be willing to do anything to resolve it truthfully. That was my great, great need. And the way that need resolved this conflict was that I had to realize explicitly that Baba was God in human form. At all times, the will of God should be the same as our will. We should make our will the same as God's will. And when I did realize that, I said, it's God's will and Baba's will being the same, that he not see me. That should be my will. And when I realized that, I was blissfully happy. You have no idea. I didn't care if he never saw me again. I was accepting and surrendering to his will. And I was in a state of bliss that was something I'd never experienced before. And it was within minutes that Baba sent for me and my wife.
First time?
In 58. At the Lagoon Cabin. I think I saw him once before that, privately. Mm-hmm. But nothing happened. Yeah. It was just like he does that to everybody that came, you see. And I decided, all I did, this running conversation, Baba said a lot of things about me. He said to Erich and this and the other one, he said, but a number of times, do you realize he's a rare gem? He was pointing to me. Meant nothing to me, because I was in such a state of happiness. No matter what he had said about what I was or what he would do for me or anything, it meant nothing. He would take me back to India, it meant nothing. I was in such a state of happiness at accepting his will on the lowest level that he was going to walk over me and not even regard me as anything. Accepting his will was the most important thing, and I was in a state that I had never experienced before. And all I did was sit down. His leg was down there. My wife was sitting over here having all this conversation with him. All I said to him in his ear was, I adore you. And I kept rubbing his leg from the knee all the way down to his feet for the longest time. In the Lagoon Cabin. And this conversation was going back and forth between them. Like Bob was saying, I would come back with him and many other things. And then he said, and Keisha said, he wants to go to India with you. And Baba said, what will you do if I take him? She said, I'm coming too. And it seemed like a very inane, light kind of conversation. And then Baba said to her, whom do you love more, Henry or me? And she said, it's because of you that I'm able to love Henry. And Baba smiled. He went like this. He got up out of his chair and pulled her up to him and embraced her. Right? So that was 58.
If you remember anything else about the thing, like you said about your family during those private interviews.
It was, those are the main things. I would come back with him, was very close to him, and my family, Keech and I were both under his divine thumb. I think he said something like, your karmic past is wiped clean, or whatever, you know, things like that.
But he said, yeah, I've given you a good family, and then he said, with your help or something.
No, I didn't say with your help. He said, I have given you a beautiful family. Be sure you take care of them. Baba has appeared in my daughter's room 3 times. And she had not told me this for a year. Until I said to her, Michelle, I wish you had met Baba. She said, I have. And then she told me, he whispered things, instructions to her. She said she was not to reveal. And she didn't tell me until a year later. I said, Michelle, maybe he was sleeping. She said, oh no, Dad. She said, I woke up and I sat up in my bed. I guess she was in her teens. At the edge of her bed, at the end of her bed, he was standing there, in light, 3 times, and And then my son was born on his birthday, and Baba sent us a cable. 25th.
My son was born.
Is that right? Is that right? Baba, I think it was, he said, his cable, I am made happy by the first of a Mirwan to be born to my dear lovers, Henry and Keisha. And something else like, my love to you both, or I love you both, something like that.
So she was pregnant in 58 with your daughter?
In 57 with Leslie, I believe it was 57 or 56. It might have been 56. It was in, I think it was 56. That was by mail. When we went down to the center, I believe my wife was 7 months pregnant with my oldest daughter. And I believe it's correct that Baba had given his permission that the center could now be open for people to come there. And we may have been the first people after that staying on the cabin on the hill. No, this was in 56. This was 56. In 62, I was in India. You know, my son was born. My wife was pregnant with Mirwan. I was in India in 62. And Baba kept asking me over and over again about Keisha. And I began to the point where I began to feel guilty.
She didn't come.
No, she was pregnant with him. It was the most critical. And every time Baba would ask him about Keisha, he would rub his stomach like this, his abdomen. See, so when Mirwan was born on his birthday, it didn't surprise me, I suppose. So
yeah,
anyway,
I mean, this year my son was born on February 25th.
I think someone told me that. That's remarkable. So that has to be. There's so much more to than you'll know. You see, you've got somebody special with you. But it's definitely a Baba person, and no question about it.
But do you remember anything about your 62 visit?
I really don't. I
you have private meetings?
Yes, but he told me some things, but I don't remember lots of things. He told me some things. I would rather they not be talked about.
Well, if it's too private.
Yeah, there were things definitely about, but they're very significant and they're very. So I don't
Go
think
ahead.
I should. No, I don't think I should say these things.
Or I'll turn off the tape.
All right, just between you and me.
All right.
I said. In the 50s, Baba indicated we should have meetings like the New York meetings in my home. So we had them. We've had them since the 50s, maybe 1956, every Monday night. And at one point in the early days, I wrote, or I said to Baba, I don't know whether I wrote or said it to him, I think I wrote to him. And I said, I really feel like the blind leading the blind. And Baba's response was, when I am behind you, there's no question of the blind leading the blind. And that took the worry away from me completely. The statement was made that my understanding of the avatar is very deep. So that was encouraging to me. And besides, my own need was to understand. That was my need. But my need was to understand Baba in terms of my experience. But in other words, Baba had to become very real for me. So from the very beginning of the time I first saw Baba, I tried to relate his reality to my own personal experience. When we received the change of Baba's plans in 1965 that we would not be allowed to come to India. Baba canceled that trip for everybody. I had built up my anticipation to feverish pitch. And when we got word that we would not, that the trip was canceled by Baba, I resolved at that time that I would do whatever was necessary to find Baba's reality, because I would not allow even Baba himself to separate himself from me anymore. And that made my resolve. And Baba was reinforcing that from time to time in his various statements in 62. What meant so much to me was he said, you have all been children in my love. You must now come and find me where I really exist. You must go home and find me where I really exist. Well, that statement, I don't know how it impacted other people, but to me, it was very meaningful because I had that enormous need. I didn't like the idea that I was not there in 54. I did not like the idea that I was not living with Baba. I did not like the idea that he was living in India and I was here. So what was available to me? Then I fastened on his words with tremendous need. He himself, God himself said, find me within. That's the only place I exist. And that was with a great sense of relief for me. So my work since that time has been intensely that. And I can tell you this, that I have found Baba within so much so that life has become far, far better than it's ever been. And my life has been very difficult. For me, it's been very difficult because of my sensitivity. But it's enabled me to deal with people on the most practical level. It's been able for me to do a job that is most difficult, requiring patience. For me to feel, for me to become very angry in my work because of the volume of cases that I have to deal with and the nature of the individuals that I have to deal with, and to see that the greatest thing in creation is in that individual, has been an enormous help to me. So Baba has helped me on the most practical of all levels. I see him in the various ways I function in my work. So Baba is entirely practical. What I see as a mistake, perhaps, is that people view Baba so narrowly. They view him in terms of the events that they could see or read about in his physical life, not knowing that he was supporting and involved in everything in creation. See? And I've seen that in my own sphere, that Baba is so actively involved in everything, guiding, inspiring your thoughts to do something meaningful, to get away from that narrow, egotistical, ego-centered self. So I find experiences every day with Baba, which is marvelous, absolutely marvelous. I got a volume of material I've written. I've sent some stuff to the Awakener, but I probably will send more things. I gave a talk in London, and she wanted me to give something in writing for their publication in London. And some young man wrote something in an envelope. He put it in an envelope, and after I left Delia's, and I opened it afterwards. And whatever it was, he said, "We will grab you anytime we can get you." He said, "Because why? Because my own need communicated to him to make Baba vital." And that's what the words he said, "You have made Baba vital for us." That's my need, to make Baba vital and a present reality. The history of Baba is significant and important only for the purpose of making him a now reality. I never think about Baba in the past. Do you know that? I never do that unless somebody asks me like you're asking me. Because he is so real and so present now, more than he's ever been for me in the physical body. That is the greatest blessing that I can think of. Because every person who has not seen Baba has that available to them. There's no one that stands between you and Baba. When I was the guest speaker out in California in 1980, I went out there not so much really knowing about whatever issues and discussions came up with the Sufis or that. When I went out there, I went across country thinking to myself, why am I going across country? What can I tell these people? What have I got to tell these people? Why should I have them pay my expense? And that bothered me a great deal. And I have to go through this all the time when I talk about Baba, because I don't feel like I have anything to say. So it means I've got to strip away everything and come to something that's very real for me. Well, when I was in California, what I emphasized most of all was the reality of Baba now, and that no one takes you to Baba. There's no one between you and Baba. That you want Baba, you can have him, but you've got to want him. And by God, if you want him, you've got him. That's all it takes. Don't kid yourself. If you want him, you'll have him. Because I had him, and I still have him, and that's just the beginning. Just the beginning. Now Baba has become such an incredible mystery for me. I love reading mysteries. And here's the greatest mystery of all. What is mystery? It's the total infinite opposite of boredom for the human being. And that's what Baba has become. If you look at Baba in such a staid way, he did this, he said that, and it's not intimate, it's boredom ultimately, because you'll get tired of words, I can assure you. He's got to become real. He is real. What is so incredible is the originator of creation is sitting there, and we are sitting there, not realizing he's the originator of creation. And that when he said, "I'm closer than your own breath," we're taking it as words. We're not finding it. Our own breath is so vital to us, and this is closer, and we're just listening and hearing him as only words. This is incredible. But my need was to discover what was behind the words that he said, to find the reality behind the words, to find the one reality behind the illusion. It has to become a need. The intimacy is so beautiful because I felt it from day to day to day. Even when I was down low, I never quit. And I've been down low many times. See? The significant thing is that everything has led me to the beginnings of the greatest possible future, the increasing reality of Baba in your daily life, not as a philosophy, not as a spiritual conviction, but as an experience. That's what's so vital. And we're right in the middle of an avataric period. Right in the middle of it. Right in the beginning. So now I feel Baba inspiring me, so I write things in the early morning. I have no doubt where they come from, because Baba is the reality in you, he's a reality in me. I have no doubts about my feelings when I do write these things. I know they're intuitions, deep intuitions, of the reality within me, which is Baba. When he said, I am your own higher self, that you'll know one day, has always been your own higher self.